Okay, so basically, I want to tell you about all the tools. This isn't figures, right? The classical optics isn't working. I want to tell you about sort of the class of tools that we have at our disposal in optical systems and what makes them interesting as a quantum system for applications. And then for the rest of the talk, I want to focus on polarization, which is probably the simplest thing to think about. It's the one that's most a direct analog of these generic qubits that you hear about in read about in textbooks. We'll talk about entanglement, and then, as I said, this is where we're trying to get to is understanding teleportation. So when we talk about an optical system, often we're talking about particles of light or photons. And these particles are described, they're relatively simple. They just have a few properties that we need to basically define to define them. Basically, they're quantum numbers. So the first one is just the energy of a photon or the color of the light. So this is the electromagnetic spectrum, very, very short wavelengths. We have gamma rays and going to longer and longer. Eventually, we have the visible light, and then we get out into microwaves and radio waves and so on. A lot of the work that we do is focused in the visible region, which is a region where we have good laser sources and good detectors. In some of these other regions, you don't have one or the other, which makes things quite restrictive. Although a lot of quantum optics now is taking place in the microwave regime, which is, you know, somewhere out in this section labeled by radar in so-called superconducting systems. But I'm going to be talking mostly about basically visible light photons. So what's interesting about the color degree of freedom is that it's actually a continuous variable. All colors are allowed. So it's quite a complex state space in which to work. Polarization is a lot simpler. The polarization of a photon has really just two basis states, horizontal and vertical polarization. We have a third degree of freedom too, which is basically the momentum of the photon or the direction that it's traveling. You can think of it in that way. So each mode, and by mode I just mean each color direction and polarization, it is described by a harmonic oscillator. So a lot of the mathematical framework in quantum optics is just the same harmonic oscillator that you would have seen in your undergraduate quantum mechanics class. The only difference is that instead of the harmonic oscillator being in position, it's actually in this degree of freedom called the field quadrature, which is like the basically the electric field at some point in time. So that's the analog of position in quantum optics. But a photon then is just a single excitation of one of these modes. So you can think of it, you start in the ground state, which is a state with no photons, which we call the vacuum. And by applying a dagger to this vacuum mode, you get a single photon in some mode K, where K kind of encodes the color direction and polarization. So once we have these basic properties, we can start to combine them in different ways. So polarization is maybe the simplest. I already mentioned these two basis states, horizontal and vertical. But you can take superpositions of those and create what we call diagonally polarized light. If there's a phase shift, we can get circularly polarized light. Right and left circular is what people usually use. But we can have other degrees of freedom in optics as well. So if we start, if we think about the color, we might choose two frequencies of light or two colors of light to encode our basis state 0 and 1. So a straightforward frequency encoding might use, you know, red light to represent 0 and green light to represent 1. we can take superpositions of these different frequencies to create a pulse of light that's localized at some point in time. So frequency encoding is actually not very common. What's more common is people use the so-called time bin encoding, where a qubit is encoded into the arrival time of a pulse of light, whether it arrives early or late. And it can manipulate superpositions of these pulses. We can also use the direction degree of freedom. This can be done in a really simple way. This diagram here just represents two paths in an optical interferometer. Oh, yeah. Thanks. Which end do you use? Is this the Canadian way to hold it? This is the, this feels better. So you can have two paths in an interferometer. So that's a kind of nice way of creating a path-encoded qubit. But you can take much more complicated superpositions as well. So these pictures here show the intensity profiles, basically if you shine a beam onto a camera, of so-called orbital angular momentum modes, or I guess in this case they're Hermite Gauss modes. But these are just superpositions of plane waves with different amplitudes. And in this simple example, we have a qubit, one of two optical paths that a photon can be in. Whereas this set of modes is an infinite dimensional, but discrete infinite dimensional state space. So there's quite a bit of, with those three quantum numbers, we can start to combine them in clever ways. And these different encodings have different advantages depending on the scenario. So for example, polarization is relatively easy to work with in the lab. It's pretty simple to understand. But if I send a polarization qubit through an optical fiber, the polarization tends to get rotated, so that's bad. But these time bin qubits are robust against the kind of noise that we encounter in fiber systems, so it's a much more practical way of encoding quantum information over long distances. Now, some of these encodings that use path or orbital angular momentum have the potential to encode a lot more quantum information in the state of a single photon. So that has potential benefits as well. Now, once you choose the implementation, there's a set of tools then that are appropriate for manipulating those degrees of freedom. So this device that I've tried to draw here, it's something called an acousto-optic modulator. So what it is a crystal that has a sound wave propagating in it, a periodic sound wave, and that creates a moving pattern in the index of refraction due to the differing pressure, the pressure differences at different points in the crystal. And light can come in and diffract off of this grating, basically. But it's a moving grating. And the light will absorb or emit phonons into this periodic vibration, this sound wave, and can lose or gain frequency. So this is basically a beam splitter for a frequency encoding. So it's a kind of tool that can create superpositions of different colors of light just by bouncing light off of a moving sound wave. Time bin encoding works by using these, so it's a little bit complicated, but the key things are these little interferometers. So this is, light comes in, this is a fiber coupler, which is like a beam splitter that creates a superposition of light traveling in this little path here, or taking this longer path here. And just by splitting the light up, having a pulse of light take a long path or a short path, we can create and measure these temporal time bin superpositions. The OAM modes, they can be created and measured using holograms. And this is an example of an early hologram that the Zeilinger group used. And what's kind of neat about it is, you know, sort of down here it looks like a regular grating, and up here it looks like a regular grating. But if you count them, there are more lines at the top than at the bottom. So there's a kind of dislocation between these two patterns that shows up in the middle. And I don't know if you think in terms of holography. Maybe you do at Perimeter. I can't think of it too much, but yeah, I'm going to have to take my word for it that if a Gaussian beam, one that has no orbital angular momentum, diffracts off of this grating with this funny dislocation in the middle, right in the center, then the first order diffraction will be so-called donut mode, like this one, which will have one unit of orbital angular momentum. The second order diffraction will have 2 units, and so on. So these kinds of holograms can be used to prepare and measure these interesting orbital angular momentum states. But for the purpose of this talk, I want to talk about polarization. So I'm going to focus on these devices called wave plates, which are just thin slices of birefringent material, usually quartz, and beam splitters, which are kind of imperfect mirrors that you can use to take a beam of light and split it into two in a coherent way. Now, just for completeness, I've only been talking about the properties of single photons. There's a field of quantum optics that works with so-called continuous variables. And the continuous variables, and we've already talked about position, energy and momentum, but that's not usually what people mean. Instead, they usually work with electric field quadratures, which are analogous to position and momentum for a standard quantum system. The electric field quadrature is basically the electric field now and the electric field quarter cycle later. So those two properties in quantum physics don't commute, just like position and momentum. And so you have uncertainty relations and properties that stem from that. But this is a property of a mode rather than a photon. So the states that people are interested in these kinds of situations are often depicted by Wigner functions that represent, for example, squeezed light, light where the uncertainty in one of the electric field quadratures is reduced at the expense of the other. And you can develop quantum protocols. This is a depiction of so-called continuous variable quantum teleportation. And there are analogs to most of the protocols that we think about, quantum computation, measurement-based quantum computing, dense coding, and so on, in the continuous variable regime. But again, I want to talk more about single photons rather than modes. These are multi-photon states usually, in all cases, superposition states. So I just want to mention that exists. Okay, so if we think about polarization, we have a two-level quantum system. We basically have a qubit, and we can describe these states using the Bloch sphere. So that puts horizontal and vertical polarization at the poles, and then typically we think of diagonal and anti-diagonal light as the eigenstates of the sigma x operator, the H plus V or H minus V, and right and left polarization as the eigenstates of the sigma Y. All right, so if we want to manipulate polarization, we can use these things called wave plates. And they're birefringent, which means that the index of refraction depends on the polarization of light. So the way to understand that is, so here's a little slab of quartz, and there's a preferred axis in the crystal called the optic axis. So if this is my attempt to draw light with an oscillating electric field that is parallel to this optic axis. So if this light pulse goes through the crystal along the optic axis, then it accumulates some phase shift of plus phi over 2. You can also have light polarized orthogonal to that, and it will accumulate a different phase shift because the index of refraction is different for these two polarizations. So that would be minus phi over 2. So if you think about the the action on the polarization state, in the basis defined by the optic axis, the transformation is really simple. It's just this plus phi over 2 phase or minus phi over 2 phase. But we have the freedom to choose which how the wave plate's oriented in space. So there's, to figure out the action in the lab basis, there's a conversion from the sort of horizontal vertical basis and back at the end. And that leads to a more complex transformation than just this, which is of the form of a rotation around z. Now, we don't usually use arbitrary phi, although there's no reason you couldn't. What we typically use are just two basically thicknesses of plate. There's a so-called half-wave plate, where phi is equal to pi, and a quarter-wave plate, where phi is equal to pi over 2. The half-wave plate, forgetting this overall factor of I, which really doesn't matter, looks kind of like a rotation matrix, but the minus sign's in the wrong spot. So it's not quite a rotation. It's more of a reflection operation. I'll show you what it does on the block sphere in a moment. The quarter wave plate does this funny looking thing. It's hard to see exactly what it does, but it has a very simple interpretation on the block sphere. I guess the key thing to note is that this transformation is entirely real. So if we start off with the so-called linear polarization, which is something on the XZ great circle of the block sphere, we can't leave it. Those are all the real superpositions. The quarter wave plate is the thing that we use to get off that great circle because of the factors of I. All right, so yeah, it's easier to think about what these things do by thinking about the block sphere instead of looking at the matrices. So if we have a wave plate that's oriented at some angle theta relative to horizontal, then what it does is the action of those 2x2 matrices on a block vector is you define an axis on the, this is the ZX great circle, which is at twice the physical angle of the rotation. So if I rotate the wave plate by 10 degrees, I'm interested in the axis that's at 20 degrees on the block sphere. And a half wave plate rotates the entire block sphere about this axis by 180 degrees. Okay? The quarter wave plate rotates it by 90 degrees, but about that same axis. So that's a way of thinking about what those matrices describe, at least if you're used to thinking about block vectors. So if I want to do something like this, which is a very common thing to do in quantum protocols, this is a Hadamard gate. I want to take my basis state H or 0 to a superposition of 0 and 1. Then I can do this with a half wave plate if I put it in the right position. So basically, the angle that I would choose is 22 and a half degrees. So the angle of rotation on the block sphere is twice that, 45 degrees. And then I do a 180 degree rotation about that axis. So that's going to take my state 0 to my state plus x. Okay, that's kind of how this thing works. And if you want to, you can always do the math using those 2x2 matrices, and of course you get the same thing. My initial state I would write as 1, 0, which encodes the state 0. And then I just apply that thing that's almost a rotation matrix, except the minus sign's in the wrong spot. Doesn't matter here. And I get out an equal superposition of horizontal and vertical. Okay, so there's sort of two, this is more useful for having discussions at the board, and maybe that's more useful for checking that you're right. Okay, so I didn't say, but it turns out that with half and quarter wave plates, you can do any single qubit unitary on the polarization. You just need a combination of them, either two or at most three such wave plates in a row. So once you can manipulate polarization, you need a way of measuring them. And this is pretty simple. We have a few different tools that we can use to measure the polarization. And these are all good good analogs to a Stern-Gerlach device for measuring spin half. So maybe the most direct analog is a so-called polarizing beam splitter, where if I have some unpolarized light going in, the vertically polarized light will get transmitted, and the horizontally polarized light will get reflected. There's something similar. There's a thing called a beam displacer. So these are typically calcite, or they can be made out of, well, anything birefringent, but they're often calcite. They can be this yttrium vanadate stuff as well, if you want more birefringence than calcite provides. But basically what happens is light will come into this crystal at normal incidence and get split up into two beams based on their polarization. Now, in these birefringent materials, there's typically two beams. The one that obeys Snell's law, so if we come in at normal incidence, Snell's law says that at this interface, we should continue at normal incidence. And one of the beams obeys that. I've labeled it in this case as horizontal. But the other beam doesn't. It's something called anomalous refraction. And it comes about because the material that the light's traveling in isn't isotropic. So it violates Snell's law. So it's not often you get to violate a law. But anyway, these can be easily used as polarizers, just like this. And sometimes they work a lot better, actually. And then they're just plain old Polaroid sheets, something that you might have in your sunglasses. And they're just typically long molecules that absorb one polarization much more efficiently than the other. So you can use them to block a polarization of light. But basically, these things allow you to make projective measurements onto the horizontal and vertical bases. And then by putting wave plates in front of them, you can make a measurement in whatever basis you're interested in. Okay. So I've talked mostly about the polarization of single photons. We need a way, in order to do anything really interesting, that's not entirely fair. Most advanced quantum protocols require entanglement of some sort. So that's this property that Schrodinger discussed way back in 1935, which he gave the German word Verschränkung, which means like arms folded. It's been translated into the word entanglement. And this is a translation of his 1935 paper, which was originally in German. I would not call that one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. So even back in 1935, people realized that this entanglement was something interesting. This is also the same year that the EPR, the famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, came out, which also started looking at the properties of entangled quantum states. So we can come up with a formal definition of entanglement. Any quantum state that can be written in this form, so this is a density operator on a tensor product Hilbert space of state system A and system B. If I can write my state as a probabilistic mixture, so these are probabilities, numbers between 0 and 1, of separable states, then the state is said to be separable. If I can't write it in this form, then it's entangled. And I don't know how much you use density operators, maybe a lot, maybe you've never seen them. When we're talking about pure quantum states, The states that are separable are ones that can be just written as products of wave functions. So if you're used to wave functions as functions of position, they're the ones that can be written as some psi of x times some, this should be some other variable, some phi of x2. Okay? So if you can't write your wave function as a product, then it's an entangled state. Now, generating entanglement in optics is hard. Usually entanglement is something that comes about when there are strong interactions between particles, between quantum systems. Now, photons don't interact with themselves very strongly, but you can use atoms to mediate interactions. And this is a field called nonlinear optics. So the way it works in the kind of classical picture is you have some positive charge. Think of this as the, if you want, think of this as the nucleus. And you have some electrons that want to be sitting at some equilibrium distance away from the atoms. If you displace the negative charge distribution away from its equilibrium position, if the displacement isn't large, usually there's kind of a Hooke's law restoring force. There's a restoring force that's proportional to the displacement. And you'll recognize that maybe as something that gives rise to a harmonic oscillator. So here's my picture. If you come along with something, some external electric field and drive this electron, it tends to respond harmonically to that driving field. Remember, a driven harmonic oscillator, if I drive a harmonic oscillator at some frequency omega, the harmonic oscillator will oscillate at the frequency that it's driven. But this approximation has to break down at some point. If I shake anything hard enough, the harmonic approximation won't work. Right? The harmonic potential goes to infinity. So if I drive this atom with a stronger electric field, basically I'm going to rip the electrons off of it. Okay? So that's something that a harmonic oscillator can't do. And something like that has to come from corrections to the restoring force, some nonlinear terms in this Hooke's law expansion. So what this means, what this leads to, is a whole set of consequences. Basically, this is when optics gets interesting. So instead of just driving the charge and getting oscillations at exactly the same frequency that you're driving it, the charge can have components of the oscillation that are at new frequencies. So a particularly dramatic example of this, which if you'd like to see, come to my lab and we'll show you, is something called second harmonic generation. So if I drive a material that has a property called chi2, which is just a certain term in the restoring force, basically, at a frequency omega in just the right way, I can generate light at twice omega. I can turn red light into blue through one of these crystals. And that's what this picture's showing. The laser in this picture, it doesn't show up very well, is actually a red laser. And it's probably infrared, which is why it doesn't show up very well in this picture. But the chi2 crystals right here, and probably all you can see is this blue light. It's like Luke Skywalker's lightsaber. But this can be an amazingly efficient process. If I have a standard titanium sapphire laser, I can convert about half of the light from red into blue. I mean, this is literally blinding. Okay, so that's pretty cool. But this is a process that happens in classical physics. This is a classical nonlinear optical effect. And in fact, you can't use it to generate entanglement. But in quantum mechanics, if a process happens in one direction, then the reverse process also happens. It's basically, you know, the Hermitian conjugate of the term in the Hamiltonian. So there's a related process. It's still a nonlinear optical process. It happens through the chi2 property of the material. But instead of frequency up conversion, it's a frequency down conversion. And it turns out this process can't happen in classical physics. So what's going on here is I can have a blue photon from a laser, shine it on this Chi2 material, and I can generate red light. But in order to conserve energy and momentum, I have to create two of these photons, two of these red photons. And this energy and momentum conservation, nonlinear optics people call it phase matching and get really upset when you call it energy and momentum conservation, but I assume there's no one here that's going to get too annoyed. What these things do is you start off with, say, a well-defined energy and momentum. And at the end, you constrain the properties of the pair of photons that you create, but not each individual one. And that's the recipe for generating entanglement. The photons that you create will have correlations in energy and momentum. And as it turns out, they're conjugate observables as well, position and time of arrival. So here's what this stuff can look like in the lab. This is a little bit old school, I would say. But here's an example of mostly a water heater with a laser attached to it called an argon ion laser. That's an optics joke. They're basically junk, but it's what we had for a long time before solid-state diode lasers were widespread. So these things, here's the one day in this lab when this laser was working. And it actually has several lines of light that it can laze at. So this one here is in the green. There's a couple lines around 500 nanometers. It's quite pretty. if you can get past the rage of keeping it running, it's quite beautiful light. But it also had a line at 350 nanometers, so very convenient. It was a very convenient wavelength for generating down conversion in the visible light, the UV line. These nonlinear crystals, there are people who are able to grow a whole zoology of these interesting nonlinear materials. This is a material called KTP, potassium titanyl phosphate. And they can be cut and cleaved at just the right angle to achieve those phase matching conditions. So this is a crystal in an optical mount. It's kind of hard to see, but you can put it in a nice mount and do so-called angle tuning. I'll talk a little bit more about that to achieve phase matching. Okay, so what does this thing look like? This is a video that my former colleague Gregor took when he was, well, these guys took, Gregor and among others, in Anton Zeilinger's group. That's where I did my postdoc, actually. And what it's showing, what it will show, I hope, is basically what you should never do in an optics lab. If you look along the beam, what's coming out of one of these down conversion crystals. So the laser itself would have been right coming straight out of the board, and they stuck a screwdriver in front of it to block the light, and then just looked on a camera to see what's going on. There we go. So what you can see are these rings. If they probably needed a cup of coffee, or maybe less coffee. You can see these characteristic rainbow rings of light from this source. The laser would have been right here in the middle, but you can see there's a bar there. And the nice organization of the different colors coming out at different angles from this crystal are a result of those phase matching conditions. So those phase matching conditions basically define or determine which colors are going to come out of the crystal at which angles. So that's their crystal on a little mount. You can't see the laser in that picture. That's what's happening. Okay? Thanks, Aggie. So just to give you a sense on how this stuff works, if you want to get good conversion efficiency, you have to satisfy these conditions. Now, it turns out they don't have to be satisfied exactly for something to happen. But if you want something reasonably efficient, you have to set these things. So if the, you know what? Never put Comic Sans in your talks because it's insidious. It just, I keep trying to delete it and replace it with Arial, and you can't get rid of it. It's, never do it. And I can't not see it. Anyway, I hate Comic Sans. So if we think about a one-dimensional problem, that problem is two-dimensional because the photons are coming out at different angles. But we basically want to have conversion between 2 omega and 2 photons at omega. So the way birefringent phase matching works is, we have an optic axis. If it's a uniaxial crystal, it means there's just one preferred axis, and that's much simpler to think about. We've already talked about this in the context of beam displacers. But if the light is polarized in the plane defined by the propagation direction and this optic axis, it's said to be extraordinarily polarized. These are the polarizations that don't obey Snell's law. If the light's out of the plane, it's called ordinary or O-polarized. And the thing that we can exploit is that the index of refraction for ordinary polarized light is only a function of the wavelength or of the color of light. But for extraordinary polarized light, it's a function of the color and also the angle. And so we can use that to tune the index. So in something like BBO, it's another nonlinear material, but it's one that we tend to use quite often. The index looks something like this. The index of refraction in most glasses, for example, tends to be higher for blue than for red. So red light travels faster in glass than blue light. And you have this gap between the so-called ordinary and extraordinary, and this is defined. This is this quantity here. So this would be the index experienced when theta is pi over 2. So by changing the angle, you can tune the extraordinary polarization anywhere in this gap, basically. The wave vector in the material, the thing that determines the phase, depends on the index of refraction and also omega over c. And this phase matching condition, this momentum conservation, just says that the wave vector, or the moment, h bar times k is the momentum, remember. The wave vector at 2 omega has to equal the sum of the wave vectors at omega. So if you just plug in this relation here, you get this expression. And if you assume type, there's different phase matching processes, but if you assume type 1 phase matching, you get extraordinary going to 2 ordinary photons. Okay? So if that's the case, then these index of refraction functions will be identical, and this will be the O. These will both be O index indices, and this will be an E. So what you can do, if you want to set up phase matching for 400 goes to 800 nanometers, you just tune the angle to increase this the index for the E ray, so that the index at 400 nanometers is equal to the O ray at 800 nanometers. Okay, so that's how this angle phase matching works. Now you can also see why this wouldn't work if you didn't have a birefringent material, because once you're in a glass, the index tends to be a function of wavelength. And if you just had a straight decreasing function, there's no way to get the index at a lower wavelength to equal the index at a higher wavelength. So we have to use these kinds of dirty tricks. So if you need to know this, 29 degrees happens to be the right phase matching angle for this particular process and this particular set of wavelengths. Now, you don't have to always have the down-converted light, the 800, have the same polarization. So we have some freedom. We can do something called type 2 down conversion, where the photons that we create have opposite polarizations. We can do that as well. And that just corresponds to a different phase matching angle, so around 40 degrees, if I remember. Okay, so that's how phase matching works, or one way of doing it. You can see that the phase matching constrains the energy and the momentum. So it naturally creates entanglement in energy, time, and momentum position. But often we want to generate polarization entanglement instead of these continuous variables. And that's certainly what we're interested in if polarization are our qubits. So the way that works, there's a clever scheme that was developed by Paul Quiet when he was a postdoc with the Zeilinger group. And you may have seen pictures that kind of look like this before. They took some photos in the lab of these intersecting rings, which have become, I would say, quite iconic in quantum optics. But this pattern here, so we already saw in the video the pattern. That was a type 1 phase matching process. It tends to generate a single cone of light. Type 2 downconversion tends to generate two sets of cones, where all the cones centered on this line here have one polarization, and all the cones centered on this line here have the opposite polarization. Okay, so that's what that, if you've ever seen that picture before, that's actually what it's showing. But the way that you can use this to generate polarization entanglement is to exploit the energy and momentum conservation in this kind of pattern. So if a horizontal photon happens to be created at this point on one of the cones, then it's going to have a buddy that shows up at a different location on this set of cones. Basically, you just take this point, go right through this center axis, and you'll find the partner photon, sometimes called the daughter photon, at this point. Okay, and it'll have the opposite polarization. Now, what you can see in this picture is that there's a point here where these two cones cross. And the photons coming out at this point are confused. They don't know which cone. I'm probably giving the photons a little bit too much credit, but bear with me. They don't know whether they're supposed to be a horizontal or a vertically polarized photon, so they don't know which cone they're on. But the phase matching conditions are such that if a photon comes out here, then an oppositely polarized photon has to come out here. And the correct description of that is an entangled state. Now, I mean, if I just told you that this, you know, this ought to be true, you would be quite right in saying that sounds, these confused photons, this sounds like you're making things up. But they've measured, this was measured years ago, and it works for generating polarization entanglement. It's pretty cool. Here's a video. Well, I think this is neat. So I took this when I was in Anton's group with a camera. This is some, I don't know what this is. Nothing. We didn't do nearly as good a job blocking the laser. We only had an hour, I think, with this thing. But what this video shows is how we can change those opening angles and the pattern, phase matching pattern, by tilting a crystal. Let's see. So what happens is if we're basically just changing the phase matching angle of a crystal and recording the image of the down-converted light that's coming out. So this is the laser beam. But when we hit a certain point, we get these two spots, basically two beams of light. One would be horizontally polarized, the other vertical. And if we keep going, then those open up into those two rings. So this is like two rings from that picture that I showed you. And eventually those rings cross. So if we collected the light from this point and this point, they'd be entangled in polarization. And so that's how we can, just by tuning the phase matching, you can control the opening angle and where those photons come in. Now, in my lab now, we actually don't use that particular source. There's something that's better in certain situations, and I'll just describe a different way you can generate entanglement. So this is an entangled photon source based on a so-called Sagnac interferometer. So a Sagnac interferometer is a little bit funny. You've probably seen things like a Michelson interferometer or maybe a Mach-Zehnder. This one, the way it works is there's a beam splitter, and light that comes out of this beam splitter can travel around a little loop in one direction or the other. Okay? And then it gets recombined on the same beam splitter. Now, the thing that's interesting about this kind of interferometer, different than, say, a Michelson. Can I draw on this? Yeah. So nice. So a Michelson interferometer has two mirrors, and the light comes in, can take one of two paths. Typically, there's a detector, and then comes out. You can see interference if you've set things up right. One property that a Sagnac solves is that if this mirror jitters around a little bit, then the fringes get washed out because only the light that takes this path hits this mirror. So you're going to play around with the phase of one of the two interfering paths. In this kind of interferometer, if I move this mirror a little bit, both paths experience the same phase shift. So it's a very robust kind of interferometer. Now, robust is the nice way of saying insensitive. If I want to measure a small change in position, this is a great thing to have. If I want something that's stable, this is a great thing to have. Robust and sensitive tend to, those are opposite. But in this case, we want robust. Now, incidentally, Sagnac interferometers, what they're often used for is measuring rotation. So they're not good at measuring displacement. But what happens is if the Sagnac interferometer is turning, then the light comes in at some point in time. And at some later point in time, if it's rotated, the beam splitter is in a new position when the light gets back to it. And that makes one of the paths, the path that goes this way, will get back to the beam splitter earlier than the light that travels this way. So it'll experience a larger phase shift. So you can use Sagnac interferometers to measure rotations. And these things are actually extremely sensitive for measuring rotations. They're used in so-called laser gyroscopes in helicopters and things like that. But our Sagnac interferometer isn't rotating, except I guess the Earth is rotating, so that's not entirely true. But we want it for its stability. And the way that this works for an entangled photon source is we have a polarizing beam splitter, not a regular one. And we have some light from a laser that's polarized in this case at 45 degrees, so that some of the light can travel this way from the pump and some of the light can travel this way from the pump. The KTP crystal is set up to generate type 2 down conversion, so a pair of oppositely polarized photons along whichever direction that's being pumped. So if we drive this crystal in superposition with a laser coming from this side and a pump laser coming from that side at the same time, we're going to generate a pair of photons, horizontal and vertical polarization, in superposition of direction. Either it's going to be going that way, it's going to be going this way. Those photons come back to this beam splitter, and they get split up based on their polarization. If they happen to be generated in this clockwise direction, the vertical photon comes out here and the horizontal there. But if they were generated in the opposite direction, then the polarizations are reversed. And you can use that to generate, if you drive it the crystal in superposition, the photons come out in superposition, which is how you make entanglement. The nice thing about this is that this source is really bright. So that argon ion laser, that giant thing, with kind of the crystals at the time, if you were really good, you might generate 1,000 photon pairs a second that are entangled. With this kind of source, we can generate up to a few million pairs per second. So it's this PP, periodically polled is what this PP stands for. KTP is a very has a very large chi2. Because it's collinear, we can have a very long interaction region. And those two things combined give you a lot more photons. Okay, so that's something that we use. This is just a picture of what the thing actually looks like in the lab. There's a little diode laser. This is way bigger than life size. The whole thing fits on a 3x2 foot board. This is a diode laser. So blue diodes is something like what you would have in a Blu-ray player. A bit fancier, but same basic idea. And the whole Sagnac loop, most of this stuff is just to direct the light from the laser into the Sagnac. This is the little loop here. So there's the beam splitter, there's an oven that keeps the crystal at a very specific temperature. And the photons come out, one goes here, and the other one goes in here into this coupler. The oven, by the way, is a different way of phase matching. So periodically polled materials you don't phase match using angle, you phase match by adjusting the temperature. I can explain that after if you're interested. All right. So you've probably seen this before. You've got the so-called Bell basis. I've just written them out in terms of horizontal and vertical. And they break up into two parts. You can think of this psi minus state. This is called the singlet state. It's analogous to the spin zero. Total angular momentum state of two spin half particles. And the other three Bell states are sometimes called the triplet space, which are related to the spin one total angular momentum. But all of these states are maximally entangled. So what we often need in quantum information is the ability to do a measurement in the Bell basis, not just prepare entangled states, but to also measure them. And the way that works, or a way that can work, is by using a controlled knot gate followed by a single qubit rotation, and then measurement back in the computational basis. But the point is there's a two-qubit gate, which we often think of as an entangling gate. In this case, it's working as a disentangling gate. But as I alluded to before, two-qubit gates are pretty hard to do in optics, again, relating to the fact that photons don't interact with each other very strongly. So here's a scheme that would work as a two-qubit gate. So this is a controlled phase. And the way this would work is I could embed a nonlinear material. I've just written it as chi. This is actually something called a Kerr nonlinearity instead of the second order susceptibility we've been talking about. This is a third order. But what it means is there's a different phase shift on this beam depending on whether there is a photon or not in this beam. Okay? So it's exactly what you would want for a controlled phase gate. So you can draw the picture. There it is. The problem is that under normal situations, this chi3 process is about 10 billion times too small to generate a cross-phase modulation of pi. Okay, so that's, I don't know, a perimeter being off by, 9 orders of magnitude maybe is considered a success. But that's a problem if you want to build a Bell state measurement. I'm just picking. Don't you have numbers like 10 to the minus 120? Those show up here. Never mind. But there's a nice trick that we can use in optics. We can use just a regular beam splitter to do something along these lines. So I talked about polarizing beam splitters, but we have non-polarizing beam splitters as well. And they just work by taking a beam of light, like a horizontal photon traveling from the right, and create a superposition of a horizontal photon traveling to the right and a horizontal photon traveling up. Now, this is a weird operation. It's not really inside of our computational state space, but we often have to do dirty tricks like this in optics to get things to work. So this is the transformation for a single photon. If you extend this and have a transformation for now two photons going into a beam splitter, this is what happens. So if the photons have the same polarization like I've drawn here, then the outgoing modes are such that you have either two photons in one mode and zero in the other, or vice versa, with the same polarization that went in. So the photons bunch up. Okay? They always go the same direction if the input polarizations are the same. If the input polarizations are different, then you have more terms. Sometimes they both go the same way. Sometimes they split up. That's what these mean. And sometimes they go the same way. But there are different phases in this superposition. Okay? So we can just exploit the linearity of quantum mechanics and figure out what happens if the photons going in are entangled. So if the photons are part of the phi subspace, so that's when the photons are the HH plus VV, the photons are the same in each term in the wave function, then what comes out are cases where the photons always go the same direction. So in all these terms in this outgoing wave function, both photons are in the same mode. You don't know whether they're in one or two, but they're together. The third triplet state, psi plus state, it's a little bit harder to see, but if you just take those superpositions that I drew before and add them up with a plus sign, then only only two terms survive, and they're the terms where both photons take the same path again. So basically, any of the three triplet states, when the photons go into the beam splitter, the photons will pair up and go out the same direction. The singlet state's special in that it does the opposite. If the photons go into the beam splitter, they always leave out of different ports. So that's just adding up those same superpositions, but now with a minus sign instead of a plus sign. Okay? So that's what's going on here. So what we can do is basically build a singlet filter or a projective measurement onto the singlet state using just a standard beam splitter. Okay? So this gets around the problem of not having a controlled phase or controlled knot gate. So this is how optical teleportation was first demonstrated. Wait, that's bouncing around. Is it? It's not just me, right?
I think it's because the door got closed.
Oh, okay. So teleportation, I'll just remind you, is the idea of sending an initial quantum state to some remote location without it traveling the distance in between. Okay, so it's a useful, it's a kind of basic quantum protocol that shows up in a lot of different applications. The first teleportation experiments were done in the late 90s, and this is the one by the Zeilinger group. So the way that works in theory is we have an EPR source, a Bell pair source, that makes basically singlet states, or any of the Bell states, say singlets. One of the photons from that entangled pair and the initial qubit state that Alice wants to send go into a Bell state measurement and are measured in the Bell basis. Then, depending on the outcome of that measurement, there's an outcome of that measurement that's sent over to Bob. Bob takes his half of the entangled pair, does a unitary, one of the Pauli operations that depends on the outcome of the measurement, and the state that comes out is the same as the one that went in. So this is the experimental implementation, and now, you know, having talked about all of these different components, we can see how this worked. So what they did is they had a short pulse laser that drove down conversion using that Paul Kwiat double ring source in two directions. So on the first pass, it created photon pairs into modes 2 and 3, basically making a singlet state on the first pass. There's a little mirror here that redirects the pulse back through the crystal again. And what they use that for is to generate a second entangled pair of photons, but then just basically just detected this one as a kind of trigger to know that a second photon was here, and then ran this photon through a polarizer. So they could turn the angle of that polarizer and set the initial state of the photon in this mode here. So that's kind of the state that Alice wants to teleport. Then their Bell state measurement was this simple beam splitter. And that was used to perform a projective measurement onto this singlet Bell state. Then when they registered a pair of detections here, so that says that the photons went out different paths, Alice just sends that click, that information that she got a detection to Bob, who analyzes the results in only those cases. And they could show that the photons that they received here had the same polarization as the ones that Alice prepared there. Okay. So that's exactly, I think we've covered all of the components to get to this point to see how this experiment worked. Intermission. So in the second half of the talk, do we have is there a short break or something?
Yeah, we should take a break until 4:15.
I'm already over time?
A little bit,
yes. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
So let's take a coffee and then I can tell you about this. But are there any questions about the first half? Things that I've been telling you about?
I kind of missed it. Did they detect all of the Bell states in that?
No. This kind of Bell filter can only project out one of them.
Okay.
So I guess they could have determined which one they wanted to detect, but the capability wasn't there to measure them all. Yeah. All right, well, let's have a coffee then.